Welcome to a DriveSource podcast. This podcast is on recovery and resolution planning, looking at the latest regulatory developments and the key implementation challenges for CCPs. Recovery and resolution plans are central to the global regulatory response to the financial crisis led by the G20 and the Financial Stability Board. The reforms will, as it is hoped, create a safer and more transparent financial system. Mandatory central counterparty clearing will significantly increase the amount of risk concentrated in clearinghouses, so they must also have the effective recovery and resolution planning programs in place. In today's podcast, we have two industry experts with us today who will be discussing the latest regulatory developments in recovery and resolution planning, followed by a brief discussion on the practical challenges of implementing such programs within CCPs. And let me first introduce you to our speakers. We have Michael Beaton, Managing Partner, Derivatives Risk Solutions. At DRS, Michael has responsibility for the firm's regulatory practice with a particular focus on recovery and resolution plans, client money, and central counterparty clearing. Michael also has a blog on this very topic, which is www.recoveryandresolutionplans.wordpress.com. And next we have Rory Cunningham, who is the Director of Public Affairs at LCH ClearNet. Rory has responsibility for public affairs and has been heavily involved in preparing LCH ClearNet's input at UK and European level to issues such as competition investigations, the bid for LSE and Euronext, the Code of Conduct, and of course LCH ClearNet's OTC derivatives initiatives. Now I'm going to start off by really looking at an overview of the regulation as it currently stands for recovery and resolution plans and looking at how they would fit into the current resolution system in the UK and Europe. And Michael, would you like to take the lead on this?
Sure. Yeah, no problem. Thanks, Julia. Well, if we're talking about specifically RRP for financial market infrastructures and particularly within that CCPs, It's worth knowing a little bit of the regulatory background. So on the 1st of August 2012, HM Treasury published its consultation document entitled Financial Sector Resolution Broadening the Regime. This was really a drive by the UK government to legislate in advance of the EU. I think it does recognize that it needs to be consistent with the EU, but nonetheless feels EU legislation is the wheels of EU legislation turning slightly slowly. And so wants to legislate in advance of that. The consultation paper itself was split into four sections. One dealt with investment firms and their parent undertakings. One dealt with central counterparties. One dealt with non-CCP financial market infrastructures. And the final section dealt with insurers. So specifically looking at CCPs, a number of issues are raised, and it's probably worthwhile just touching in a little more detail on each one of those. So firstly, what would the scope of any UK legislation look like? And basically what the UK government was saying was that resolution powers would apply only to systemically important CCPs. Nobody's quite sure what this means yet, except we do know that HM Treasury envisages that it would not have the power to transfer clearinghouses into public ownership. Moving on, the objectives of resolution, they largely mirror those that we already know for deposit-taking institutions. However, the Treasury suggests adding one additional objective, which is the maintenance of critical CCP services. And certainly that is a recurring theme through a number of bits of regulation from various bodies, which we'll come to discuss in a bit more detail later on. Another issue that was raised were conditions for intervention, and where the Treasury was coming out was really that if a clearinghouse had breached or was likely to breach its conditions for being authorised as a clearinghouse, then that's really the trigger for early intervention by the UK government. However, it's worth noting that there were one or two other conditions attached to that, one being it must not be likely that other actions would enable the clearinghouse to once again meet its authorised conditions. And notwithstanding that other actions could actually restore the clearinghouse to compliance with its authorization conditions, if any of those actions would undermine the continuity of clearing services, then nonetheless the UK government could step in early. The consultation paper also suggests giving the UK government specific powers to direct the actions of a CCP, but only if this is in the public interest, with respect to a couple of aspects such as protecting or maintaining confidence in the UK financial system, or protecting or maintaining services provided by the CCP. This power to direct it wouldn't just extend actually to the CCP, but also directly to actions of an administrator in case the CCP failed. Another topic which was discussed at quite long length in the consultation paper is the issue of stabilisation powers. Now, by and large, these are largely the same as those powers that we've already seen for banks. However, before being able to exercise a stabilisation power to resolve a failing CCP, the Bank of England would have to be satisfied that this exercise of this power was necessary in pursuance of certain specified public interest aims. So they've introduced this kind of public interest requirement before power can be exercised. Beyond that, the Bank of England also have powers to suspend members' termination rights within the CCP, to transfer membership agreements and clearing member positions, to amend CCP rules of operation, as mentioned before, to direct the actions of an insolvency practitioner, and also, and this is I think something that we'll probably come to chat about a bit later on, to directly impose losses on shareholders and CCP members. One topic which is always discussed at quite great length, whether it be bank resolution or non-bank resolution, is the question of safeguards. And by and large, the safeguards in relation to a CCP's resolution would be the same as that for banks. So we're talking about things like the principle that creditors should not be discriminated on grounds of nationality, that there should be compensation for those affected by the exercise of stabilisation power. So effectively, it's the no creditor worse off than in liquidation type scenario. And you also have measures to protect against partial property transfers. The final issue that was discussed at some length in the consultation paper related to the concept of loss allocation. But if it's all right, I'll probably mention this in relation to the responses that HM's Treasury received to its August consultation paper. This was published on the 17th of October, and the Treasury said they received about 45 responses to their initial consultation, most of which were largely supportive of their position. But they did change their position in a few aspects. I have to admit, not particularly major, but as far as CCPs are concerned, the government have proposed to include an additional objective for intervening in a failing CCP, and this objective, as we discussed before, is one which seeks to maintain the continuity of critical services. It's very much a recurring theme through a lot of regulation and proposals dealing with the question of non-bank resolution. It did note the mixed response from industry regarding intervention powers in general, but in fairness, they regarded this as justified given the systemic consequences which closure of a CCP's critical functions could have, particularly where there may be no obvious substitutes for the CCP itself. The government also recognises that if a recognised clearinghouse does not provide central counterparty clearing services, it should actually be excluded from the CCP regime altogether, meaning we think that it's more likely that they will be covered by proposals relating to non-CCP financial market infrastructures. On the question of loss allocation, the government noted there was strong industry opposition to its proposal to allow resolution authorities to impose losses on clearing members of CCPs. Here we're talking about losses which go above and beyond those dealt with by normal CCP loss allocation provisions. Specifically, it was felt that these proposals would cause uncertainty, could potentially lead to distorted incentives such as early termination and exit of clearing members, might actually put UK CCPs at a competitive disadvantage, and could have capital and liquidity consequences for clearing members. In light of this, the UK government decided not to pursue the proposal, which is very interesting. However, it remains of the view that taxpayers should not be expected to pay the cost of restoring a failed CCP. So it'll be interesting to see how this one eventually plays out, because at least in theory, losses could still exceed those which were catered for within a CCP's existing loss allocation provisions. At the moment, the government is minded to make loss allocation rules mandatory for the purposes of securing authorisation as a recognised clearinghouse within the UK. And it did say it was going to reconsult on this issue in due course. So at the moment, we're in a slight limbo, if you like. So that was very much the position as set out currently within the UK. One thing Treasury did do was to specifically defer legislating on a certain number of areas in deference to EU proposals that will follow in the future. And the areas we're specifically talking about were bail-in, transfers to asset management vehicles, and stays on contractual rights, specifically early termination, close-out netting, that kind of thing. But interestingly, on the 5th of October, the EU actually published a consultation paper on pretty much exactly the same topic. So it was interesting to see where there were similarities, where there were differences between the UK position and the EU position. And I think, by and large, the truth is there aren't that many differences at all. The EU did try and define this concept of systemic risk, which it defines by reference to size, interconnectedness and substitutability. Interestingly, the UK government actually shied away from that, and specifically, I think, suggested that a definition of systemic risk actually wasn't that helpful. The EU did also note that CCPs had a particularly high risk of contagion. They emphasised the importance of ensuring continuity of critical services, just like the UK. They advocate early intervention if a CCP is in breach of its regulatory requirements, again, just like the UK. As regards resolution triggers, pretty much the same as for banks under the draft EU directive, so we're really talking about the point of non-viability. However, with respect specifically to CCPs, there's a further condition which is to do with the disruption of services must have a systemic implications. And again, that's pretty much the same position that's been adopted by the UK government. Resolution powers, so again, we're talking about things like removal of management, appointment of administrators, transfer of assets, bridge institutions. These are all pretty much the same as the UK government's the powers that it proposes for resolution authorities in the UK. Resolution tools, so asset separation, bail-in, bridge institutions. Again, these are all pretty much the same as the UK. And as I mentioned before, the UK has actually specifically deferred consulting on some of these issues until more transparency comes from the EU legislative process. So they're determined that these provisions are going to be consistent from day one. I think ultimately, the two are going to have to be consistent. More specifically, UK legislation will have to defer to the EU directive. And as I said, the UK aren't keen to have to wait, but certainly they're very mindful of the need to be consistent. And to date, I think it's fair to say that their consultation paper clearly indicates they're treading exactly the same path as the EU will.
Okay, thank you, Michael. And Corey, do you have anything to jump in here on with regards to regulation you've been paying attention to?
Yes, just a little bit. I think it's worth mentioning that the work being done in the UK and in Europe is against the backdrop of work done at the global level. There was a consultation on recovery and resolution of financial market infrastructures undertaken by CPSS ELSCO under the BIS in the summer. That ran from late July to late September. I don't think the responses have been published yet. And there is also continuing work going on recovery and resolution at the Financial Stability Board, who just last week, I think, published some a paper concerning global SIFIs. However, it does come right down to, for European CCPs, it does kind of, the rubber hits the road, if you like, because under the new EMIR regulation, which is coming into effect, well, it's coming into effect now and will require all EU CCPs to seek reauthorization sometime during next year, then all CCPs have to put in place a wind-down plan that includes defining how long it would take to reorganize themselves, possibly with capitalization, restructuring its services, merging or transferring activities to other CCPs, which is all part of recovery and resolution plan. So even before the EU consultation that Michael referred to is complete, and before necessarily there is perhaps regulation put in place in each of the EU states, all CCPs will have to have wind-down plans in place in order to be authorized next year. So this, in fact, is what CCPs like ours are focusing on pretty urgently at the moment. Just a brief word, there is also similar provisions under the Dodd-Frank Act, under Title II of the Dodd-Frank Act, which allows there to be resolution of systemically important institutions, although there is a question as to whether the definition of the entities covered under the Dodd-Frank Act, which refers to financial companies, actually applies to CCPs in the US or not, and that's something on which CCPs are looking at very closely.
Great, and the next question I want to go into is, what are the circumstances and scenarios in which that could take place to evoke recovery and resolution plans? And Rory, do you have some circumstances that you can outline for us here?
Yeah, sure. I think you can divide it into three areas. One is the classic situation, which I think most people will think about, is that there's been a series of more or less simultaneous catastrophic defaults of clearing firms that has effectively eaten through the entirety of a CCP default waterfall, that is to say the margin that the members provided as well as the default fund. CCPs will have to have, under CPSS ELSCO principles and in any case, provisions to determine what happens if in that very, very unlikely and hard to imagine scenario. But that is one thing where it's important that if the losses are sufficient that the default resources are used up, that it's clear what happens next in order to protect the wider financial markets. Another one is where there may be some similarly catastrophic operational failure in a CCP that means it loses capital in some other way from investments or some operational failure. In that situation, there is no member default necessarily, and it has not been able to use its default resources, so the default waterfall is not available. That's the second scenario. The final one, I think it was hinted at by Michael, there's also a requirement for European CCPs under EMIR to put in place plans to enable continuation of services should it be the case that they lose their authorization. It's quite hard to actually, in practically speaking, see how that would happen. It's not something that would happen suddenly, but it may be one has to cater for the situation that a CCP is clearly, for some reason, in breach of its requirements, and the regulators decide that it has to go, and the business has to go somewhere else. So those are the three areas that CCPs have to plan for and consider.
Okay, great. Thanks, Rory. Now, we've talked about this a little bit already in terms of regional regulation on recovery and resolution plans, but is there a need for a cross-jurisdictional approach to this? And Michael, do you have any views on this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the answer to the question is a resounding yes. I think the Lehman collapse showed that basically any sizable financial institution has huge cross-border activity and requires coordination if you're going to achieve some kind of successful resolution. Specifically with respect to CCPs, it really applies equally. I mean, CCPs by their nature work across jurisdictions. In contrast, governments and resolution authorities are quite national in their outlook, really. Although in fairness, I think the moves towards the single supervisory mechanism may begin the process of changing this within Europe. But nonetheless, investors, participants, and firms in general need legal certainty in relation to many areas that would be of importance in relation to the resolution of any CCP. For instance, priority of high-level principles, is it preserving critical functions versus, or is it minimizing losses? How is confidential information to be treated? How does bail-in apply? What is the applicable creditor hierarchy? What safeguards can be expected? All of these questions need a high degree of international coordination if creditors and investors and the public in general are to have the degree of certainty that's needed. From a regulator's point of view, actually, I would have thought effective resolution, from their point of view, they would also want to know that they're working towards a common goal and that stakeholders in their jurisdictions will not be disadvantaged through the application, for instance, of national insolvency law. I guess they would want to know that other regulators define things like critical functions the same way they do. So many of the legal issues in a resolution scenario really involve these multiple legal systems, and a coordination, a degree of coordination is really a vital ingredient of success. Think of things like debt write-downs, stays on termination of rights, suspension of contractual rights, branch resolutions, provision of emergency liquidity support. All of these things ignore national boundaries. And so if you really want an effective and a rapid resolution of a failed CCP, there will be a lot of coordination that will have to have taken place before the event. One thing I'll just mention before I finish, which I found quite interesting, was a position paper published in June of this year by the Institute of International Finance. Now, admittedly, it was looking at banks in particular, but it did propose an international convention to govern the coordination and cooperation of resolution of international financial institutions based on the FSB key attributes document. It was an interesting position paper. I think it actually merits a lot more consideration as a way of bringing together all the various stakeholders that you'd need if truly you want RRP for CCP to work.
Yeah, I would just support what Michael said. I'm no lawyer, but I think it's increasingly important that, as Michael said, these are global markets, CCPs operating globally, that as global banks and customers all around the world are using CCPs in other jurisdictions, it's very important for them to understand, as far as is actually practically possible, the nature of the risks that they're undertaking. They must be important to recognize that assumptions that they may make about how laws and procedures operate in their home jurisdiction aren't necessarily the same elsewhere.
Okay, perfect. Now, I want to change gears a little bit here and talk about the practical challenge of implementing recovery and resolution plans for CCPs and about the actions that will be taken should a CCP unfortunately fail. And Michael, do you want to start and give us kind of the legal view on the critical functions of actions that you see that need to take place really in the get-go?
Yeah, sure. I think there seems to be general agreement that when you're talking about resolving a CCP, the most important thing is ensuring continuity of critical CCP functions. And in essence, I think when you're looking at a CCP resolution, it will boil down to probably about three things. Bail-in, which is a very rapid, a very powerful, a very immediate resolution tool. There's going to be a lot of porting of transactions will have to happen, so that is going to have to be there's going to have to be effective mechanisms for that. And I suspect you're also going to be looking at perhaps transfer of certain functions of the CCP to a bridge institution. I think it's probably worth noting, I can't imagine the failure of a CCP happening in a very kind of a binary fashion. It's not going to be healthy one day and just have disappeared the next. The market is going to be aware of this, and there are going to be a number of actions, I think, before you actually reach resolution. But nonetheless, it does bring us on to the practical difficulties of what you do to actually implement RRP for CCP if you had to. There are particular problems about the kind of the three areas that I mentioned, particularly if you take something like the concept of bail-in. In theory, at least, it works quite nicely for a bank. The issue is CCPs tend not to issue debt, so it makes traditional bail-in a bit more difficult to implement and raises the question, well, just how do you affect bail-in for a CCP? At the moment, there are a number of solutions being suggested. Most of them relate around this concept of kind of haircutting clearing member margin. Now, that does have the advantage in that it's immediately available as a remedy. However, it may well result in margin increases across the board. Potentially, it could depart from principles such as no creditor worse off than insolvency, may not actually follow insolvency rankings, and it could also make losses actually fall directly on clients of clearing members. Some clearing members are looking to pass these losses on. So given that, there has been some consideration of other solutions, so specific liquidity calls on clearing members. Has the advantage that it avoids a random allocation of losses, but then again it is rather pro-cyclical, so that may not be the solution to all ills. Another suggestion is to establish ex-ante resolution funds. This does avoid a negative counter-cyclical impact, but then again you bump up into problems as to how you'd actually calculate appropriate levels of contribution. So, more recently, there has been a concentration on whether or not CCP should have the right to terminate non-defaulting clearing members to actually restore a balanced, a matched book, if you like. It has the advantage that it's an immediate solution, but it is rather random and therefore potentially unfair. They're very much the issues that are associated with bail-in. But again, if, for instance, things like other resolution tools, the business transfer tool, could be quite difficult because you have few alternative service providers and you have just the differing nature of financial market infrastructure assets and liabilities, operational constraints such as IT system incompatibility, potentially serious competition law issues, and even national political agendas may come into the picture at some point. And by that I mean, for instance, the national political agendas that are currently really creating fragmentation amongst CCPs under Dodd-Frank, EMIR, that kind of thing. You can see this as something that national agendas would kind of get in the way from businesses being transferred from one jurisdiction potentially to another. Lastly, and I'll just mention this very quickly, in the context of resolving a CCP, it would be quite difficult to suspend payments to counterparties of CCP. This would be more likely to actually amplify systemic risk. And so there's less of a focus on that as a resolution tool and perhaps more of a focus on suspension of termination rights. But that, in a nutshell, is kind of some of the legal issues associated with resolving a CCP.
I'll just raise an additional point, which is part of the mixture. The Basel Committee has recently been working on and proposed revised rules for the Basel Capital Framework for banks to put capital to maintain capital in relation to the exposures they run to CCPs, both the CCPs margins or trade exposures, as it's called, and CCP default funds. And the question does arise of whether, depending upon the structures of loss allocation that CCP has put in place, that will extend beyond the requirement to to fill a default fund, whether there will be additional capital charges in some way to cover the potential risk of banks incurring losses in addition to what they're putting up in margin default fund.
Okay, great. Well, one other question I wanted to go into. Now, I know this is a little bit more for the banks who are dealing with recovery and resolution plans, but I want to ask how firms might be integrating recovery and resolution plans into existing risk management processes. And Michael, you work a lot with banks in this area. Can you give us or outline some of the issues that you see in terms of integrating with risk management processes?
Yeah, sure. You're absolutely right. This is a huge challenge for banks at the moment, which they're going through the process of. RRP in many ways is just, it's a huge data assimilation exercise, and it requires you to get a very fundamental understanding of the data that is currently within your organization and that you're generating all the time and how it relates to each other. It presents a huge technological challenge, and I'm a lawyer, but we do some work with banks and technology companies who are helping banks understand this data, and it really is forcing them to look at the way their entire organizations are structured in terms of systems that may or may not be linking to each other but need to, never had to in the past, simply because you have to answer a new question. It's no longer good enough, for instance, just to look at a traditional market risk or a credit risk view of life. There's at least a third aspect to all this, which is, okay, well, how does this affect my resolvability? And the reason you need to answer that question is it has such huge potential impacts. Going down the line to things like Vickers, if you're a UK bank, a robust RRP could be the difference between an additional 3% RWAs and not. These questions of, how do we find out what it is we're doing, and how do we improve ourselves to become more resolvable? It all boils down to data. How do you understand it in the context of the risks that you're currently running?
Yeah, I wouldn't want to sound complacent, but I would trust that, in generally speaking, even for a large organization like ourselves, that the issues may be a bit less complex than in a bank covering a wide range of retail, wholesale, and infrastructural activities. Given the CCP is all about risk management, then we are already, have done for many years, integrated the view we have of our risks, both in terms of the core clearing activities, the risks we run on our payments and investment activities, and so on. So, again, without wishing to say it's suggesting it's actually easy, then one would hope it is something that's quite tractable for even a large, complex organization like ourselves, in order to support our risk management offering.
Yeah, I would think that is right, yeah.
Okay, great. Now, the final question, and one I always like to ask, is really about the silver lining. And my question to the panel is, are there any benefits or business opportunities that can be born out of recovering resolution planning for CCPs? And Rory, do you want to give us your CCP view to begin with?
Certainly. Well, I don't know about specific business opportunities, and I'm not sure that if there were some I could identify, I'd want to go into them in too much detail. But it's as I mentioned before, I think it is vitally important for the CCPs, not only in order to fulfill their regulatory requirements, but in order to demonstrate their quality, in our case, the world-leading risk management that we currently operate, that we are transparent about how we operate. So exactly how do we calculate our margins, how do we assess our default requirements, how would we plan in this situation so that, how do we protect clients' assets, how would we ensure that in the very worst case, which we don't think is going to happen, but we have to prepare for, that we have to be resolved, that that is transparent and known to the market, not just to our members, but to our client, our members' clients and their clients.
Yeah, I think from my point of view, and again, this relies much more heavily on experience with banks rather than CCPs, and I think the point actually probably does apply more directly to banks than to CCPs. But for the kind of forward thinking, there's huge benefit to actually getting a grip of this information, of this data, and understanding what's going on in terms of the risks that the institution's facing, in terms of the ways those risks are documented, in terms of businesses that are performing, businesses that aren't performing, how businesses could be sold, how to go about it, how not to go about it, and issues that might be thrown up along the way, such as we've already discussed, competition, that kind of thing. So the benefits, not just the direct ones, like the 3% RWA savings under Vickers that I mentioned before, are potentially huge. I mean, you're talking even about an understanding of transaction level exposures and how they would map to, for instance, contractual rights. If you have a better understanding of bail-in, you can optimize the way that your capital structure is put together. So, yeah, for the enlightened, I think there are potentially large benefits at the end of the rainbow. Having said that, I don't think it'll be a particularly easy job to get there.
Okay, great. Thank you to our speakers, Michael Beaton of DRS and Rory Cunningham of LSH Clarinet. We have many other articles and different types of information on this topic on derivsource.com. So for people who would like more information, please go directly to the website to see other articles. And again, Michael has a blog on this very topic, which is recoveryandresolutionplans.wordpress.com. Thank you to our listeners for tuning in to this DerivSource podcast, and please join us again soon. Thanks very much.